This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Terry Zwigoff, directed the film Ghost World and co-wrote the screenplay with Daniel Clowes, who we just heard from. Ghost World is based on Clowes' comic book of the same name. Terry Zwigoff also directed the acclaimed documentary Crumb about the underground comic book artist R. Crumb. Zwigoff has seen a lot of comic books over the years, in part because his wife has worked for a comic book distribution company which puts out work by Crumb, Clowes, and many other artists. After the success of Zwigoff's film Crumb, he was sent a lot of screenplays and received offers to direct Hollywood films. But he said the stories seemed generic, false, and contrived. I asked Zwigoff how he chose Ghost World as his next film.
As I was struggling to find something to make a movie out of, my wife kept pushing me to make Ghost World into a film. And I went back and reread it and thought, you know, this doesn't really have a story. It's just these little episodic slice of life vignettes of these two teenage girls. But I really loved the two characters. I thought they were really well written. I thought the dialogue was terrific. And in fact, I wound up asking Robert Crumb about Dan Clowes because I knew he lived, I think, in Berkeley. And since I lived in San Francisco, I wanted to meet the guy and talk to him about the possibility of just working together on a screenplay instead of adapting this Ghost World per se. I actually liked all of Dan's work I had read everything he had done, and he's a pretty prolific guy. And I was impressed with his writing skills, the fact that he could write such good dialogue and the fact that he was so good with characters. It was very uncomic book-like. It was much more like a novel, you know, where the characters are much more three-dimensional. And then when you go to pitch it in Hollywood, the irony is that they want very one-dimensional characters. And they that's sort of why they like comic books, I guess, down there. But this was very uncomic book-like in that regard.
What did you think were the most important changes you needed to make in order to adapt the comic book into a movie?
I thought we had to add more of a story, more of a plot. And I also just didn't want to do the same thing he'd already done in comic book form. It just wasn't interesting to me to repeat something. So we started going through and talking about different stories and different plot lines. And I was, at the time, very much influenced, I think, in retrospect, I was very much influenced by this movie Scarlet Street by Fritz Lang, this 1945 Edward G. Robinson film. And I started throwing out plot ideas based on that film where this older guy gets involved with this young sort of femme fatale. I was also influenced a lot by that Vladimir Nabokov book Lolita, and I love the Kubrick film, of course, and that sort of worked its way in as well. I don't know, all these different things sort of worked their way into the story, and we talked and talked and worked this thing out, and just wound up coming up with something new where this Enid character gets involved with this older guy who's a record collector. And I think originally I added that Seymour character who's played by Steve Buscemi so well in the film because that was just something, some world I knew very well, that record collecting world, and he's rather based on myself. It was very easy for me to write him because I just sort of exaggerated things about myself.
The Steve Buscemi character in Ghost World collects blues 78s.
Blues and jazz, yes.
And he's a character who has no real social skills, and he's particularly self-conscious and insecure around women. So what are some of the characters of yourself that you heightened in him?
Well, I didn't think I heightened all that much sometimes, but when I read it in the press, it's sort of alarming because I remember the first couple days I hired this woman who was the costume designer who was really great, Mary Zofries. She did the costume design on Fargo and also Kingpin, two of my favorite films, and two very divergent films in terms of costumes. She said, "How do you want Seymour to dress?" I said, "I don't, just look at the way I dress, you know, sort of normal. Just look at the way I dress for the next 3 days and base it on me." And she did. She just had him wearing like sort of dark conservative clothes, you know, long sleeve shirts and stuff. And then I read in the press, everybody says, "God, he has the most pathetic wardrobe of any human on the planet." I said, "What? What? That's sort of normal looking. I don't understand it. I don't get it."
Well, it's also that everything, well, some of his clothes seem slightly too big, and they seem to be droopy
on
him. I think that's part of the look.
Maybe she based that on me. Yeah, I don't know. I thought he looked pretty normal to me. At the same time, every time we'd get done with the day and we'd wrap for the day, Steve would immediately change clothes and change the way he combed his hair. I could tell he was very uncomfortable inside that character.
Let me play one of the early meetings between Enid, the teenage girl, and Seymour, the middle-aged record collector played by Steve Buscemi. And earlier in the movie, she's bought at a garage sale that he has. She's bought a blues anthology, and she's coming back to say that she actually really likes it. So here's the scene.
Yeah, it took me a while before I got a chance to actually play it, but once I heard that song, it was like...
You liked it, huh? Yeah. There's some really rare performances. What about, did you like the Memphis Mini?
Yeah, that was good, too. The whole record was good, but that one song, Devil Got My Woman, I mostly just keep playing that over and over. Do you have any other records like that?
There are no other records like that. Actually, I have the original 78 in my collection. It's one of maybe five known copies.
Wow.
You want to see it? I can run upstairs and get it.
Sure, yeah.
Watch my stuff.
There you go.
It's only about B minus. It's got an incipient lamp crack, but it plays decent as I recall.
Oops, I dropped it!
Jeez.
I was only kidding. Seymour, are you all right?
Yeah, it's just, it's very valuable.
The Rare 78 from Seymour's collection that Enid really likes and that gets her kind of interested in early blues is Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman. Why did you build the scene around that particular recording? What does it mean to you?
To me, it was the first record I ever heard that really affected me deeply. It was very shocking to me when I heard that record. I was in New York. I was at this guy Nick Pearls' house, who's now dead, but he used to run Yazoo Records, and he was a rich guy. He had the world's best collection of blues records, pre-war blues records. And he was just playing records, and I was in this room looking through his trade pile in a corner, and I just stopped dead when, you know, like two bars into that record. I don't know. It was an electrifying record to me, shockingly weird and strong.
Why don't we listen to it? This is Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman.
Oh, Lord, I'll be the devil. I'll be that woman, man.
That's Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman. It's included on the soundtrack of the movie Ghost World. My guest, Terry Zwigoff, directed the film. There's a record collecting scene at a party that Seymour gives. And, you know, everybody there except Enid is a collector of rare records. And all the conversation they're having is about the condition of the records in their collection. And she kind of thinks it's pretty cool. And Seymour says, you think it's healthy to obsessively collect things? You can't connect with other people, so you fill your life with stuff. I'm just like the rest of all these pathetic collector losers. Do you really think of collecting as being pathetic?
Yeah, in some ways. I had a hard time writing that line as well. I almost took it out because I wrote it. Actually, I wrote it with Charles Crumb in mind. I wanted to make Seymour have this sort of tragic self-awareness that Charles Crumb had.
Charles Crumb is R. Crumb's late brother.
Yeah, and I thought that would be very strong in the character. I can't really be that objective and tell you whether or not I really have that quality or not. I guess to some degree I do, but I kept wavering on whether or not to do that, to keep that line, and it seemed too obvious, and other ways it seemed very, very truthful. So I don't know. I wound up going with the line. But yeah, there's a little bit of truth in it, sure.
My guest is Terry Zweigoff. He directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry Zweigoff. He directed the film Ghost World, which he co-wrote with Daniel Clowes. The film is based on Clowes' comic book of the same name. It's about two smart and cynical teenage girls who see themselves as misfits. Steve Buscemi plays a middle-aged guy who collects blues 78s. I really love the record collecting scenes in this. There's a scene that I particularly like later on in a bar. You know, Enid and Seymour are going to a bar to hear an old performer who Seymour quite likes and is really disappointed that this guy isn't the headliner. And the headliner
right,
is this
Blues Hammer is the headliner.
Yeah, they're this really awful bar band. And so Buscemi's sitting next to a woman at the table, and she says, "Oh, I really love the blues," after this performer that Buscemi likes has performed. And he corrects her. And he says,
"Can't help himself."
Yeah, he says, "Actually,"
he has to correct her.
He says, "Actually, technically, what he was mostly playing would more accurately be classified in the ragtime idiom, although, of course, not in the strictest sense of the more classical ragtime piano music like that of Scott Joplin or Joseph Lamb." I thought it was really funny the way he corrected her. And then she goes on to say that she really loves the blues and that, you know, if he loves the blues, he's got to see this band Blues Hammer because they're so great. And, of course, they're really horrible and they're everything probably that he hates about Ersatz contemporary blues bands.
White guys sing about plowing behind mules.
Yeah, and singing in black dialect and singing about being old.
I've been through that experience many times.
Have you?
Uh-huh. I cannot tell you how many times I've been dragged to a bar by some, usually not a girl I've met at the bar, some girl I've just started dating, and okay, we'll go hear some blues, try to find some middle ground in the relationship, and something like that would happen. And the problem in that scene was how far to push it before the audience actually got it. I could have made that a lot more subtle, but it's hard to tell, hard to be objective.
Is that as alienating for you as it is for the Buscemi character when someone says, "I really love blues," and you think, oh, a bond, a connection, and you realize what they love isn't anything like what you would call blues?
Yeah, I don't even bother to try to turn people on to old music anymore. If they come to my house, they always, out of politeness, say, "Oh, all these old records, let's hear some." I say, "Eh, it's all right, my record player isn't working." I'm happy to keep it for myself. I don't care if anybody else ever hears that stuff. It just drives the price up. What do I care? I can't afford to buy the records I want on eBay anymore.
now, you wrote or co-wrote the bar band song, the Blues Hammer song, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Tell me about writing it. Did you write the music and the lyrics or just the lyrics?
It was just sort of a generic, you know, three-chord 12-bar blues thing that a friend of mine, Craig Ventresco, who did a lot of the soundtrack on Crumb, actually did most of the music behind it. He actually played the slide guitar part, even though he only plays like old-fashioned music. He's able to like play all the parts of that modern band. And I just came up with that, those stupid lyrics. They're just so offensive to me that some white guys would, but that's not that far from reality. White guys singing like that in black dialect, talking about, you know, plowing behind a mule, lordy, lordy.
Well, let's hear the recording. It's actually on the soundtrack of Ghost World. No, the Steve Buscemi character was largely your creation, the record collector character.
Yeah, I originally added him to the story because I actually wanted an excuse. We kept going down to Hollywood pitch meetings to pitch this film, and the first thing they'd say is, "Oh, great, it's based on a comic, that's good, that we have X-Men, and that's going to make a lot of money, and Lara Croft, and Spider-Man and all this stuff, Batman's all made money." And then they start talking about the soundtrack. They really want a pop soundtrack. That's great. We have teenage girls' comic books, and we'll have like this hit soundtrack with NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys and who's ever big this week, you know. And I just said, you know, got to figure out some way around this. So I wrote this main character into the film who collects old music just so I could use old music.
Now, the director of photography in the movie is the same director of photography who worked on Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother, which is a beautiful-looking film with color almost being like one of the characters in the movie.
Yeah,
colors
great.
Used so well. So who's most responsible for the color? The director of photography, yourself as the director, the fashion coordinator was actually choosing the clothes that everybody wears in the movie?
It's all important to some degree, all those choices, and we all talked about it. The first thing I did with the entire crew, including Mary Zofries, the costume designer, and the production designer, Ed McAvoy, and Afonso Beato, the cinematographers, I dragged them all out to a shopping mall in L.A., and we had a camera with a long lens on it, and we just looked at people walking by that I would point out going down this escalator that we had a good view of from about 100 feet away. And I just say, take a picture of that guy, look at this guy, look at that clothes there. And then we studied these photographs, and a lot of the colors, a lot of the wardrobe itself, a lot of the hairdos on the extras, all that stuff, I said, I'm very, very interested and concerned with creating an entire world down to the extras. All the background details are very important to me. So we studied those photos. It was very helpful.
What did you want from those background details, from the people, for instance? What kind of look did you want the extras to have?
It was really an homage to Robert Crumb. It was really something that I picked up from knowing him and from his comics. The way he sees modern Americans is just these sort of fat, unhealthy, out of shape, schlubby people shuffling along, most of them rather depressed, and they're just wearing these clothes that are ridiculous on them. They either have big ads for, you know, Nike or The Gap on them, or they some sports team, or, you know, some old guy wearing like a jogging outfit, and you know, he can barely walk. He's got a walker, you know, he's shuffling along. And, you know, stuff that's too stylish for their age or too stylish for their, you know, for their body type, their hairdo. All that stuff was important to me. And that was completely an homage to Robert Crumb.
What were some of the hurdles, if any, that you had to get over with the studio who maybe would have wanted the movie slightly more mainstream?
Well, the studio that we wound up with, United Artists, MGM, had a negative pickup deal, so they weren't too involved in the film creatively. They got it when it was done. The people that were involved were Granada Films in England, and domestically a company called Mr. Mud, which is my old friend Leanne Helfen, and her partner John Malkovich. And they held final cut of the film. We had our disagreements in the editing room, but eventually got to the point where they all backed off and sort of said, you know, this film's got to have one vision and let me do what I want to do, which is sort of remarkable in hindsight that I got to make this film and have final cut of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the look you wanted the two teenage girls, the two leads in the movie, to have. You may disagree, but I thought that they are more attractive in the movie than they're depicted as being in the comic book. And I thought, you know, that the slightly less attractive look in the comic book helped explain their feelings of alienation from the other kids in high school and, you know, from the world in general. Did you want to make them more attractive?
One of the best actors I could get was my main concern. I was less interested in what they looked like.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that you know, the other main concern is getting the studio to finally greenlight a film that, you know, you're going to have actresses in that they have no interest in. They want the biggest actresses that are out there. And at the time we started pitching this thing 6 years ago, the biggest actress they were interested in was Jennifer Love Hewitt, because she had just done this film, I Know What You Did Last Summer. So they all wanted her. And I just said, you know, it didn't strike me that she was too pretty, although I think she's very pretty. It struck me that she's sort of too perky and well-adjusted and happy. And I said that alone would not make her work in that part. And to me, it was more important that these actresses sort of got the mindset of those characters, which I thought they did very well. There is something genuinely off and eccentric about Scarlett Johansson. There is something generally of an outsider about Thora Birch. That was more important to me than the looks.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they are a little bit too beautiful for those parts. I thought they were very, very good-looking, you know, actors. But to me, the performance supersedes that.
My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed the film Ghost World, which he co-wrote with Daniel Clowes. Zwigoff also directed the documentary Crumb about the comic book artist R. Crumb. What was most interesting and most upsetting to you working on your first fiction film? Your other films have been documentaries.
Right. Well, the biggest challenge and the most fun was actually working with actors. And when this thing was first starting up 5 years ago, it seemed like it was a go project right away. We had this one studio that was going to make the film. My producer, Leanne Helfand, called me and said, pack your bags. You're going to move from San Francisco to L.A. in a month and start pre-production. So I sort of panicked, and I went through the Yellow Pages and found an acting instructor and went to them, and I said, can you give me a crash course in directing actors in a month? I have to direct the actors in this feature film. I don't have the slightest experience doing it. And to me, that's what makes or breaks a film, you know, good characters, good performances. So this guy looked at me and thought I was kidding. He said, I can't teach you how to do that in a month. My advice would be to start going to acting classes and go to as many as you can before this thing starts up. So I did. I started going to acting classes here in San Francisco. Gene Shelton has an actor's workshop on Sutter Street that's really good. She was very nice to me. Let me sit in the back and audit the class for free. And went to a bunch of other acting classes. And this financing fell through and thing dragged on for 5 years. I went to acting classes for years and years. It was very helpful.
How was it helpful?
Well, you learn how to talk to actors. You learn how to get a good performance. You have to learn how to relax them and get them focused and actually listening and affecting each other in a scene. And there's a lot of different techniques and tricks and methods for doing that.
Name one that you used in the making of Ghost World.
One method that I use?
Yeah, to relax an actor.
Sometimes to relax.
Or get them in focus.
I try to keep the set a very fun set. Everybody that was there was always cracking jokes and laughing and having a ball. That was the first thing, just to keep everybody relaxed. And then, you know, oftentimes with Thor, I'd go through the script line by line. Just tell her the intention of the way it was written. If she didn't quite agree with it or didn't quite get it, you at least tell her the intention of it, of the what you meant in this line. Would be a start. And then you try to give them positive, playable choices. You know, you try to give them like a verb instead of like an end result, something to play, something active to play in the scene so that they don't get too self-conscious and stagey with the performance.
Thora Birch has a particularly clear way of letting you know what she's feeling when she's giving a line by the slant of her eyes or the tilt of her head or the expression on her face. And it never looks like she's mugging for the camera, but you know what she's feeling by watching her.
A lot of it in a film, they just have to think it. They don't have to indicate it anymore. They just have to think it, and you can see it in their eyes. That's why I never liked plays as a kid. My parents used to take me to plays. I was never that into them. I never quite got the idea of it. Like, how can you get the same feeling from this performance sitting in the front row as you do in the back row? It's just, you know, it's different in films. Why I like films. You can be very nuanced and very subtle in film.
So are you already thinking what your next movie will be?
Oh, boy. I guess I better pretty soon. The standard of living has been raised. My wife made us get some cell phones. New computer. The overhead's going up. I have to pay the bills. I just turned down a $10,000 offer from The Gap to have my photo taken for The Gap. I said, what do you mean have my photo taken for The Gap? They said, yeah, we're doing an ad campaign and billboards and magazines of young, hip film directors. I said, I'm 53 years old. I'm not young. I'm not hip. I don't even wear blue jeans, you know. I'm sort of short, disheveled, graying guy with white, hairy arms. You're going to put me in like a Gap t-shirt? I think that's going to sell like Gap clothes? As tempting as that $10,000 was, you know, they employ sweatshop laborers in Saipan. You're not going to endorse that company. Screw them.
Were you flattered that they thought you could be a hip model for their clothes?
Clearly, you know, obviously they never even seen what I look like, and they know nothing about me or my politics. I'm sure they never even saw the film. If they saw that film, it'd be clear to any thinking person, this is the last guy who's going to endorse the Gap. It's like 6 years of my life went into making some big statement against, like, this corporate consumerism sweeping the planet and ruining the earth.
Terry Zwigoff, I thought we could end your interview with one of the 78s that's included on the CD, the soundtrack CD from Ghost World. Why don't you choose one that you would like to introduce our listeners to?
One of my favorite records is The Palms of Maracaibo by Lionel Belasco and his orchestra. It's recorded in the late 20s. It's West Indian calypso music, really beautiful.
Well, let's hear it. Terry Zwigoff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Terry Zwigoff directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. He also directed the documentary Crumb about comic book artist R. Crumb.